My name's Howard. I am a PM on the Azure Platform and Tools team at Microsoft. We do a whole bunch of things from ASP.NET to Azure itself to NuGet and a whole bunch of other stuff. After hearing that that last bit about me being the one between you and beer, I'll just say thanks a lot for coming. And I have a few things.
No.
So let's just start out with the problem that we're trying to solve. This is me, last year. And as you can tell, I grew up way too fast. I will have you note that after years of therapy, I can actually now read the newspaper right side up. But the reason I have this picture here is I want to start out by just telling you a little story. So when I was this age, last year, I hated washing my hair. I don't know. It was my thing. Hated washing my hair. And aside from bribing me, my mom had coined a phrase for getting my hair washed. She called it a necessary evil. Okay? In business, we call it cost of doing business, right? And the problem is that as developers, and usually as developers within a larger IT organization, we end up falling into the bucket of a necessary evil, of a cost of doing business. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. You know, sort of your typical development process starts out with, in case you missed the irony of the picture, mysterious requirements. And then that usually moves on to our design, which, given ambiguity, we design complexity, naturally. And then we present that, although it's not working software yet, we present that to the business. And because it's still vaporware, and because their requirements were ambiguous at best to begin with, we get this sort of, sounds great, kind of response. So then we spin up, and we do development for, I don't know, a few months, a few weeks, depending on how agile we're calling ourselves. And then we go into the pit of reviews. Now this can be everything from geopolitical to localization to security, any kind of reviews. one of the things at Microsoft is, you know, this pit of reviews is literally a pit that takes a long time, and of course the output of that is more development. So we're still cruising along, and then we get to deployment. And I don't know, is this an accurate representation for any of you as far as deployment goes? Right? Who's who? Right? We're Luke, obviously, as developers. But we end up in this fight with operations in order to actually get things deployed. And then finally, we go through all this and we get back to the business review. And lo and behold, they're actually not as impressed as we expected them to be. So then the finger pointing starts, naturally, right? Operations blames dev, dev blames the business. Right, this is a pretty standard thing. And the Agile consultants come in, and they blame everyone for not being Agile enough. So then we see the cloud. We get the cloud. And as developers, I don't know about you, my first thought is, sweet, well, now I can avoid this fight. And what we're really doing here is we're not avoiding the fight. We're just kicking it down the road a little bit. And ultimately, the fight materializes. It's passive-aggressive, so now it's worse when it actually comes out. And this is how the business sees us. Right? We're just two kids fighting, and not surprisingly, they're not impressed. And again, we're back to being a necessary evil. Right? So, the problem is that if we look at the last few years, we've seen organizations that have done significantly more. We've seen organizations that have taken advantage not just of technology, but of cloud technology to actually completely revolutionize the business domains that they're in. Fairly classic example, right? Bookselling has never been the same since. Or television, movies, radio. And of course, we can't forget about the arguably most successful of them all, I said arguably. So, how can we actually switch from, oh look, I've got a bunch of VMs that I can now thumb my nose at IT, how can we think about the cloud as actually adding value? Now, there's basically two parts of this talk, two stanzas, if you will. The first is going to be this part that we're about to delve into, so brace yourselves for a new lens. And that is that I want to at least get you to think about how the cloud can add value in a little bit different way than perhaps how you've thought of it in the past. After that, we're going to go through a bunch of specific Azure implementations that I believe accomplish how the cloud can add value, and they also happen to be some of my favorite aspects of Azure, so you get what I like. So how can the cloud add value? Well, let's pull back for a second and think about this from another dimension. 5 points that don't matter. Does anybody know who this is? This guy named Dave Campbell. He's like a technical fellow on SQL Server, which means he's like at least 100 IQ points higher than me. But he has a really interesting point, and he had it in the context of data. But we're going to apply it a little bit more broadly to the cloud. And that is, what we really want to do with the cloud is see how quickly we can validate questions or ideas. And let's put it in that broader context. So how many of you guys have taken like a computer science algorithms class? Data structures and algorithms. Great. So you know that one of the big tenets is that if you're having trouble with an algorithm, one of the first ways of tackling the problem is seeing if the underlying data structure is best suited for that algorithm, right? So we're gonna think about it a little bit the same way. So if we look at the problem from a slightly different perspective, and we look at it in the context of business, while it takes hard work and skill and blah, 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 so much of success in business is in doing the right thing, being in the right place at the right time. There's a luck factor, as much as I don't want to believe that that's true. But the problem is if we look at the way that we develop software, we're usually not in a good position to actually take advantage of being in the right place or doing the right things at the right times. And so like you can see, we have two outcomes generally. One is we invest in the wrong things, and the second, which is very related to the first, is that because we're spun up doing the wrong things, we miss the opportunity to do the right things. So here's the big idea. Here's the big point of this whole thing, is that the cloud adds value and that it enables us to test ideas at the speed that we have ideas. And it does this in a bunch of different ways. But sort of the umbrella for all this is that it removes barriers that create friction for testing ideas at the rate with which we have ideas. Four specific things that I've pulled out here that we're going to actually walk through in a little more detail is, what is the time to start? Right? What is the time to do all of those activities which are required just to get a project off the ground? Right? The second is, it removes barriers around how we go about testing an idea. Do we have to use a particular framework to use the cloud? We have to use a particular language, particular deployment technology? Right? How easy is it for us to take the skills that we have and apply them to the cloud provider? The next one, and this is becoming a lot more important, we'll get to it, but the cloud should remove barriers around the size of an idea that can be tested. How many of you, out of curiosity, are working with big data today? A small number. I expect that 3 to 5 years from now, every hand will be up. Right? If you remember those company logos that I showed just a second ago of big successes in the cloud, there's something that all of them have in common, and that is that they all process vast amounts of data in order to do something unique for the users of those applications. And then finally, what is the friction from taking a validated idea and maturing it, moving it to a sort of full-scale application? And this is sort of the canonical, okay, well now I'm serious, do I have to rewrite? Which sounds absurd, but it's pretty common. So we're going to spend some time going through each of these things. Now, Windows Azure is a bunch of things, and at the core of it, you have virtual machines. Like virtualization is one of the sort of core foundational technologies. Right? But then Windows Azure builds on top of all that, sort of building up, right? So let's say VMs are the base. Sort of hosting environments, let's say, are built on top of that. So you, everything from websites to cloud services, web roles, worker roles, so on and so forth. And then Windows Azure includes a variety of application level services that you can tie into in order to just use, right? Not build on top of, just use. So we'll see a couple of these in action. But let's just start in at reducing the time to start, right? That was one of our big value props. Now, this is based on a very technical term that came out of MIT, so you know it's legit, called yak shaving. It did come out of MIT, but I don't think it's an academic term, just for clarity. And you can read the definition, but it goes something like this. I'm going to completely plagiarize Seth Godin. I guess it's not plagiarism because I just cited him, but I'm going to completely take something from his blog. Yak shaving works kind of like this. I have a task of I want to wax my car, right? So the sort of sequence of dialogue goes like this. I want to wax the car, but my hose is broken, so I need to go to the hardware store. But the hardware store is on the other side of town, and if I don't take the toll roads, it's going to be a giant mess. So I need a toll pass. Well, I can borrow a toll pass from my neighbor, but I feel really weird borrowing that pass from my neighbor because I borrowed his mushy pillow a while ago, and I haven't returned it. But I can't return it because my daughter ripped out some of the stuffing, and so I need to get some yak hair in order to restuff it so that I can return it, so that I can get his pass, so that I can drive across town to the hardware store, so that I can get a hose, so that I can wax my car. And so before you know it, I'm at the zoo shaving a yak so that I can get some yak hair to stuff the pillow. And if I try and repeat all that again, my head might explode. But you get the idea, right? What are those things in software? Any of this look familiar? Somebody just throw it out there because this room isn't too big and I can hear you. How long, on average, does this sort of thing take? Yeah, setting up. So a while, weeks? Yeah. Yeah. So let's have some fun with this. By the way, this is what a yak actually looks like. I don't know about you. I didn't actually know this until I put this deck together. So now we all know something. So let's actually get started. And what we're going to do, we're going to do a couple things. Here's a couple things I'm going to show you. The Azure command line tools. Who's using the Azure command line tools? You must use the Azure command line. You know the greatest thing? Hanselman said this, and I asked if I could steal this bit from him, and he said no, so of course I'm going to. He said, and I think this is true, he said the greatest power of using the command line for these activities is not so much in the ability to execute a command, but it's the ability to execute the command in context of a for loop. Right? It's one thing to say, create me a new website. It's another thing to, or create me a new virtual machine. It's another thing to say, create me 1,000, right? And I can do that with two additional lines of code, depending on what language you're using. So here's what we're going to do. So we're going to look at the Azure command line tools. We're going to look at Azure websites. Who here is using Azure websites? Anyone? A couple people. Who here is using version control-based deployment to Azure websites? Okay, this is going to be super fun. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. I'm going to just close this down for a second. So this is the Azure command line interface. I think in the back you may have trouble seeing the gorgeous ASCII art, but you know it's legit when there's ASCII art. And this gives you the ability to manage a whole bunch of assets in Azure. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to go over to, let's see, where am I at the moment? Okay, perfect. So we're going to create a new website. We're going to create a new website. We're going to create a new Git repository. We are going to deploy it using Git. Okay, so let's just start there. So we'll just say, let's see what sites we have currently. So we'll say Azure site list. And you can see it's actually executing this against my Azure repository. And let's do this. Let's create a directory. So we'll create HD web site 001. Hopefully that folder won't be taken. And then let's just go over to it. And let's do Azure site create. And let's call this HD site 001. And let's put it in location East US. Now let's see here. so that was fun. But actually, you know what? I want to do something a little bit different. So that came back, and I can now see it. But what I want to do, I'm going to add one other command here. I'm going to say /git. Okay? Oh, it's going to gripe at me because I already have a site called that. So let's see here. Now, let's see what we've got here. So if we say Azure site list, and we can see that I have HD site running. Now, just to show you that I am not making this up, let's go out here and let's reload our Azure portal. Is everyone familiar with the Azure portal? I'm seeing heads nodding. That's good enough. Great. So we've now created, so I can do git, status. And you can see I now actually have a Git repository initialized as well for this. So let's just go ahead and add a file here real quick. And we'll just do sort of a canonical hello world kind of a thing. So we'll say sublime text index.html. And that's fine. So we'll just say HTML. And we'll do hello world. And we'll do the same down here. Okay? So we'll save that off. And let's go back here. We'll do another git status just to see. Yes, we in fact do have that. So let's just do a git add everything. And oh, one other thing. People that are familiar with Git will also appreciate this, that when Azure initialized our Git repository, it went ahead and created a remote for our actual Azure website repository. So now I can just do a git commit, and we'll just call this first commit. And let's just push it. So we'll say git push Azure, because it created that remote master. And watch it go as soon as, let's see if it actually, if I can remember my password. I've discovered that I'm actually quite terrible at remembering passwords. So we have now deployed this thing. And what does that mean? Well, if we go over here to the portal, let's just open this guy up. And you can see this section here called deployments. And what you can see here is that our first commit was received, and every time that commit gets received, it actually will trigger a new build. Now, because I know this is something that you've all always wanted to do, that is launch a web browser from the command shell, you'll be happy to know that there is, in fact, a command. So Azure site browse, HD site 001, which will, in fact, launch a web browser. Because I know that was the one thing you came here for, is that you wanted to see how do I do that. And you can see that we have a site, right? Now, that in and of itself is pretty cool. Like, we've done a whole lot of stuff with a very, very few commands. But the reality is that for a lot of projects, you are probably already using a repository like, say, GitHub, right? Or CodePlex, or Bitbucket, or TFS hosted, right? You already have some version control system that you're using. Well, one of the great things about this source control deployment mechanisms is that you can actually just hook up to an existing source control repository. So let's just go over here and do this. Now, before this talk, I had pushed up to GitHub basically I created the default MVC template and I just pushed it up here, right? So this is my repository. It's called Howard Durking DevTeach MVC. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go over here to websites, and I'm going to add a new one. So we'll just do a quick create, and we'll say this is HD DevTeach, and we'll create it in East, so that's great. And we'll let this thing go ahead and create. Take it a couple seconds to provision. And now it's running. Okay. So what I'm going to do over here is I'm now going to go down to Quick Glance, and you can see I have set up Git publishing, I have set up TFS publishing, I have a bunch of different options. And so I'm just going to go ahead and say set up Git publishing, and it's going to create that Git repository. Remember, Git is distributed, so it's going to create a local repository in Azure, and then it's going to give me the option to push from my GitHub repository. So I'm just going to click this deploy from GitHub repository, and it's going to ask me to authorize. It just uses standard OAuth, so this is not a huge deal. And you can see now it lists all of my GitHub repositories that I want, you know, so I can pick one for this particular website. So I'm going to select Howard Durking DevTeach MVC. And what we can see here in a second is that this will actually, just the act of connecting this to my GitHub repository will trigger a deployment. So, you know, fingers crossed, come on, do your thing, Azure. Don't make a liar out of me. Ah, there we go. All right. So you can see that we've actually now started a new deployment. And hopefully I haven't changed anything as I was messing around with this so that it will succeed. But a couple things that I want to point out. Good. Okay, it succeeded. So a couple things I want to point out here. One is that it actually built my MVC project. So this deployment mechanism can look for project files, can look for solution files, and it can actually find the right stuff and then call build on that. The other thing it can do is it's fully integrated with, for example, NuGet Package Restore. How many of you guys use NuGet? If not, you got to use NuGet, really. You've got to. How many of you guys use NuGet Package Restore? Okay, so let me give you the, because a few people didn't raise their hands on using NuGet, let me tell you 2 seconds what we're talking about. So NuGet is a package management system that is specific to your project. So basically, rather than downloading a bunch of assemblies and putting them in a lib folder and creating references that you then have to make sure to go out to all those websites in the future to see if things have been updated, instead of all of that mess, you can simply go to NuGet and say, add package reference to whatever package you want, Elma, jQuery. And then NuGet will tell you when updates are available for that package. Now, NuGet has a feature called Package Restore, which basically allows you to delete your package's folder, and then when you rebuild, NuGet will look to see what packages you're missing and then go out and get those and bring them back in. The benefit is that if you're using a source control repository that you have to pay for example, you don't have to pay the extra cost of maintaining all of the packages that you happen to be using. So the reason I tell you that is because I've enabled package restore on this. I have no packages folder. But as a part of doing this build and deploy, the mechanism here actually went out, went to NuGet.org, pulled in the packages that it needed before building or as a part of building. So that gets me to deployment. Now, let's just say, for the sake of argument, that I have a bug in my application. I know that sounds crazy. I know that you never have bugs in your applications, but just sort of go with me for a second. So let's see, let's go to GitHub, me, and I believe I have a clone of this. So let's just make sure that I have the latest origin master. The other thing I will point out while this is coming down here is that you can, in fact, configure this deployment to pull off any branch in Git that you want to. It's not just master. I'm using master because it's easy and I didn't have to change anything. But that's certainly not to say that you have to. So let's find a file and break it. Sound good? Let's see. Let's go over to programming. And we'll go to GitHub and me and DevTeach. And let's go into the solution and find, I don't know, let's find the index controller. Index controller is a great place to break stuff because it's bound to, or the home controller, because it's bound to show up very quickly and easily. So the easiest way to do that is to throw a new exception. Right? So let's go ahead and save that. And just like we did before, we will come in here and we'll say git, and we'll just commit, and I don't want to do add and commit is different operations because I'm lazy. So introduced a bug, and then let's push it. So git push origin master. Now, just a little Git-ism, you can see that I'm using Origin here instead of Azure because I'm maintaining this in GitHub, not Azure. Figured that, you probably already knew that, but just in case. Okay, so now if we go back over here to the portal, what you can see is that my new commit to GitHub should trigger a new deployment. Deployment. So as soon as that goes, then here we go. So you can see that our commit has now shown up. It's going to do a build, and you can see that that succeeded. Well, so we think. Right, so let's actually go back over here. Where's PowerShell here? So let's do an Azure site list just to see. And this will let us see all of our sites. And then we'll do that awesome open the web browser experience. So we'll say Azure site browse HD, or yeah, dev teach. And what should we get? We should get an exception, right? Ah, and an error occurred. So the question then here is, you know, well, holy cow, now the room is on fire. You know, what do we do? Do we have to like go back to Git and like fix it right there? Well, we can't do that because our customers are screaming. So we go back to the Azure portal, and there's a very, very simple way to revert. Right? I simply go back to this deployment and say, redeploy. And now it's simply going to take that deployment and push it back to our site. So now, if I go back to my browser, which I just closed, now all should be well with the world again. Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's move on. Move back to PowerPoint land. Happy, happy PowerPoint land. All right. Now, some of you may be seeing this and saying, the internet freaks me out. Probably not if you're here at a dev conference. But some people think this way, right? I mean, the internet is a giant hole by which people can crawl through and take my stuff. My father-in-law thinks that. It's okay. No judgment here. So if you happen to be of that persuasion, this is probably something that you have not heard of. I had not heard of it until actually quite recently. This product, and you'll want to follow it for the link, but enables you to install Azure, effectively, onto a set of nodes within your organization. So you basically push this thing onto your computers. It, like, you know, the Borg has you. It takes them over. And then it gives you the Azure portal, as well as your command line, all of your stuff. Everything I've just shown you can work exactly the same way within your infrastructure. This is ridiculously cool stuff. So yes, one of the things I would definitely suggest is, you know, get about 20 computers, put them on a subnet, if you have more time than I do. But this would be a really cool thing to play with. All right, so what did we say? The second point of friction that we want to remove with the cloud is that it shouldn't restrict how you want to test an idea. Show of hands, how many of you use or sort of exist in that hybrid space? You use some Windows stuff, you use some Linux stuff, you do some .NET stuff, you do some Node stuff, you do some SQL stuff, you do some Mongo stuff. How many of you exist in that world? Two of you. Well, then you guys are going to freak out. It's going to be awesome, but I'm just going to warn you. So the idea is this. Your cloud shouldn't care about what language you want to use, right? Similarly, I stole this slide from Hanselman. Don't tell him, okay? So you can run Linux, right? If you want to run Linux, great, run Linux. We'll do that in a second. Well, in fact, a second is up. Let's actually do that. So let's pop back over here. If I want to create an Azure VM, so again, just like in with websites, I have this great command line interface. So let's say Azure VM list, right? And this will give me all of my existing VMs. One of the things that we've also done is we've provided you a set of virtual hard drives for creating new VMs. If you want, if you have a VHD that you already use, that's a virtual hard drive, if you have an existing image, you can upload it and then it will show up here. But if you want, we just provide you a list of default images. So we'll say Azure VM images list, or image, sorry. So let's go over here. And you can see we've got a bunch of stuff that ranges from Ubuntu. That's what these canonical ones are. We've got some stuff with BizTalk Server, because we all know how easy that is to set up. We've got some images with SQL Server. We've got SUSE. We've got a bunch of different images for you to choose from. And like I said, you can always add to this list by uploading your own. But in this case, here's what we're going to do. We're just going to create a brand new Ubuntu image. And like all good things in software developer, that in software development, that starts by copying and pasting. So I'm going to copy this, the name of this image, because I don't really want to try and type that in. And we will simply say Azure VM create, and the next parameter is what do we want its DNS name to be, right? So we'll call this HDLNX 4, right? And then we need to give it the image name. So let's paste that here, and let's tell it the location is going to be East US. Oh, I missed a parameter. That's the one downside to command line is you have to remember the parameters. So I'll give it my username. We'll say East US is where it's going to be. And then the great thing, and I know James was catching some havoc about this earlier, but I'm going to side with him on this. The great thing about this is that we can enable SSH simply by that little switch right here. And I'll show you why that's really awesome in just a second. But basically now, I can go off, and it's going to look up the cloud service, it's going to create it, and it's going to spin for a second. It says it's retrieving storage accounts here because the actual VM instance, the image that's created, it puts it in blob store. So any changes you make to the state of the VM are preserved in Azure Blob Store. So it's, you have persistent storage here. So it's going to go do its thing and come on back. Please come back. You know, I was telling somebody that doing a demo or doing a bunch of Azure demos is always a very risky thing at a conference because you're basically beholden to the reliability of the network. So far, you know, we've been doing okay here. So this might be the point that that breaks it all. So while it's doing that, I have created another VM, another Linux VM, and it's completely blank. Like I created it and I started it, and that was the extent of what I did. And so here's why SSH is so stinking cool, is I am going to simply SSH into Howard Durking at hdlnx2.cloudapp.net. And it should ask me for some credentials, which I may remember. Let's see. And so what we're doing right now, for those of you that may not be as familiar with Linux, what you can see here by this prefix here, this terminal is now actually the virtual machine's terminal. Right, so anything I do from here, I'm actually making changes on the virtual machine. And that includes things like installing software. Right, so it's not like I need a remote desktop session to go download an MSI and double click on it in some crazy slow sort of virtual user interface. I can simply do standard, you know, sort of Unix package manager stuff. So I'm just going to do apt-get node.js. install would probably be helpful, wouldn't it? So apt-get install node.js. And now it's actually installing node.js on this vanilla machine. Do I want to continue? Of course I want to continue. This is a demo. They need to have a switch demo that doesn't prompt you for anything. But until they get to that, I'll happily hit the button. And actually, while that's happening, let's pop back over here and let's see what's happening. Oh, now it wants my password. Okay. Now, I was telling some people that there's a bug in how PowerShell works with the command line tools. Watch this. If you want to see my password, don't tell anyone. But see, now it shows up below, so it's totally okay. Yeah. Yeah, just... somebody should report that. Yeah. All right. So now I've installed Node over here. I can, you know, verify that by just saying, yep. Okay, so now I've got Node installed on this machine. Now, what I want to do here, let's actually go back over to the portal, and we'll go over to virtual machines. And you can see now I have this machine running. Now, one of the really cool things that you can do, so if I want to do a website on Node or anything else, one of the things that's generally considered a big no-no is bind the app directly to port 80. Some people say it's a security risk. So we don't want to do that, but what we can actually do is we can add a new endpoint, and we can say that the name, we'll just call this public web and TCP. I'm sure you all know this, but just as an FYI, public service announcement, if you're doing HTTP, it runs on top of TCP, so you really are having a TCP endpoint. I know, I'm sorry, that was totally like questioning your intelligence, and that's not what I was intending to do, but just in case. Yeah. So public port, we're going to say is port 80, because we actually do want this thing to ultimately be exposed over 80. But internally, we're going to use port 9200. Right? So now we don't have to run our application under super user, we can run it under a normal user, but it can still, you can still get to it through port 80 publicly. So let's go ahead and do that, and it's going to take a few minutes for it to reprovision the configure the firewall and some of that stuff. But while it's doing that, let's actually pop back over to our little SSH thing here, our SSH terminal, and let's just say, let's make a directory for our project. And we'll go ahead and change directories over to it. And then, I don't know, like, let's just, I know you guys aren't Node developers, and that's cool, like, but let's write, like, 6 lines of Node just to show that we can do this. Okay, so let's just say app.js. I'd like to dedicate this Vim moment to James Kovacs. He's kind of my Vim sensei, if you will. Let's just say HTTP is going to be equal to require HTTP, right? And then let's just create a quick server. So http.create server function, and it'll take a request, and it'll give a response. I heard somewhere that that's what HTTP is supposed to do. And let's just take to the console. Let's just log request received. For, and let's just add the request URL. Okay? And I'm actually, it was kind of fun to do this because when I did and I started watching the console logs, it reminded me that browsers will always, by default, issue 2 requests, one for favorite icon and the other for the actual. Because when I was looking at it originally, I was like, why am I getting 2 requests every time I hit this stupid thing? That's why. And then let's do this. So let's say response, we'll do write head. And we'll give it a 200, well, success. I mean, we're controlling it, so let's make it successful. And then also let's give it a content type. So we'll say content type of plain text. No, it's text plain. If I'm wrong, then the browser will just do something fun, and we'll go from there. And then let's just end the response. So we'll end the response, and as a part of that, we'll write the body. So hello world, yo. No, I didn't write yo, but I could have. So we'll do that, we'll close it off, and we'll close off this function, because if you know anything about Node, you know that the most fun part of it is 500 levels of nested closures. I'm just kidding, it's not really fun. And then let's listen at port 9200, right? Because that was the port that we opened up. And then we'll just say console.log started server on port 9200. Okay? Is that pretty straightforward? We're not trying to make you into Node experts here, but it's always good to be exposed to some new stuff. So We'll save that. And now we should simply be able to say node app.js. Well, that was kind of anticlimactic, but I don't know. Let's go see if it works. So if we go back over to the Azure portal, you can see that my SSH endpoint is now configured, which means that I should be able to browse over to HDLNX. You can tell I've never done this before. That cloud app, port 80, and lo and behold, our node app worked. Now I want to pause here for a second because I want it to soak in how much stuff we just did in that very small amount of time. Right? We've created a machine. We've provisioned a machine. We've installed software on the machine. We've configured the firewall for the machine. We've created an app. We've browsed to the app, or we've started the app, and we're able to browse to the app. This is a big deal, right? We've done a lot of stuff that used to take forever to get going with, right? Our barrier is very, very low in this context. So there you have it. Linux, Node, Azure, it all just works, right? Let's pop back into PowerPoint land for a second. All right, big data. Like I said, this part is where I take the things that I like and I fit them into the message I'm trying to convey. So I really like big data. I'm a, what you might say, a big fan. Horrible. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about ambient data. Who here has heard that term, ambient data? Of course not. Dave Campbell just said it like a week ago. So ambient data is, as you would expect, it's the data that is all around us, right? Social media is kind of the most obvious example of ambient data. But IIS logs, pretty decent source, right, if you want to know what's going on. We also have all these neat devices now, right, from our phones, GPS. I saw this really cool example. It's not really cool, actually. It's scary. Of a oven that is internet connected so that you can preheat it while you're on the bus home. somebody's totally going to get sued for that. But it's going to be awesome in some way. So this is this really interesting quote that I found. That the amount of ambient data out there has basically grown to around 2 zettabytes. Does anyone know what a zettabyte is? Because I sure didn't. Okay, so let me give you an idea. This is thanks to Wikipedia. It's right freaking there. That's big. That's really big. Let me put that in context. That is 1 trillion gigabytes. We have 2 of them. 2 of these things, and it's increasing exponentially, right? So the opportunity and just the reality of big data, yeah, it was here yesterday, right? So much of the value that's going to be created in business over the next, I don't know, I would argue 10, 20, 30 years is going to be in this space by itself. Now, I know that there were some sessions on data warehousing, and I think it's really important to sort of differentiate the typical data warehousing approach from what we're talking about when we're talking about processing big data. Who here has done some data warehousing, OLAP or any dimensional modeling? Okay, good. So you guys, that's good. So you're familiar with this. Does this look about right? Is this kind of the process? All right, you figure out what questions you want to ask, which is usually like you go to the business and say, what do you want? And they go, I don't know. What do we got? I don't know. It's kind of like what's for dinner with me and my wife, right? It kind of works like that. But then you collect a bunch of data. You build a logical model, physical model, ETL, fix the ETL, tune it, and finally you answer the question. But you probably know where I'm going with this, right? That only tells you if you ask the right question. And this could take a while, right? So how do people actually want to know things? Like, how do we want to answer questions, right? Well, I want to know if it's the right question to ask. If not, then I want to stop right there. Or maybe I have an idea to ask a different question. Is it worth asking again if it is a valid question? And if so, I want to repeat it and I want to push it into production. The problem is, and this is, again, if you want to see this like a whole presentation on just this, I completely ripped this off from Dave Campbell. Like I said, he's like 100 IQ points smarter than me, so why would I not want to? The problem is that the standard data warehousing lifecycle really only gets you here. Right? And so the idea, what we want to do with big data, is kind of like what I've been saying. We want to reduce the amount of time to know whether you're doing the right thing. In this case, whether you're asking the right question. So here's the data flow for big data. You've got your 2 zettabytes hanging out here. And what you want to do is you want to get everything you can, right? To use the analogy, you're kind of like the game show contestant in the money thing where it's blowing all around, right? You want to grab everything you can, and you want to basically put it into this digital shoebox. Again, a Dave Campbell term because it makes me sound smarter. And then from that, you have a whole bunch of processes that can be either sort of very traditional. This is kind of be like your ETL processes, where you put various aspects or various projections of this information into traditional data warehouses, cubes, etc. Or whether you start putting it into machine learning algorithms, mining algorithms, all of these more emergent technologies. So if you want to be the next Amazon.com, right, you're going to feed this stuff into your recommendation engine. And this process is called information production. And the goal of this big data flow is to, I think there's two things, really. One is that it's important to decouple the process of grabbing ambient data and putting it in the digital shoebox to make that as lightweight as possible. And the way that we achieve this in this data flow is that we don't impose any structural requirements up front. Whatever format it's in, that's what you grab. Throw it in the shoebox. And we decouple that from the process of information production. So that's the second thing. And information production is where you massage that down in whatever format it's in into whatever system you're actually targeting it to. Now, how many of you have heard of MapReduce? Okay. So, MapReduce and distributed file storage, or it's not hardware, but distributed file storage, whatever. It's two papers that were published by Google that basically outline how to do massive distributed processing of large sets of data. And ultimately, those two papers became a product called Hadoop. Anybody used Hadoop? Okay, cool. Well, we're not going to actually like run a Hadoop job because it takes a few minutes, so you won't be too disappointed because you don't know what you're missing, literally. But basically, what Hadoop is it's a framework for doing large-scale distribution and parallelism processing over giant data sets. And let me give you a little bit more of an illustration as to how this works. So Hadoop uses MapReduce. And you can see kind of how these things are broken up, right? So the first thing it does is it splits up your input into groups that it can then fan out across multiple nodes, right? It then runs a function that you define called map. And the purpose of your map function is to take the input, whatever form it's in, and basically process it such that you can emit a key and a value, right? That then goes back into the framework where it collates the keys, right? And then ultimately calls your reduce function with the key and n number of values that are collocated to that key, right? And then finally it writes your result back to the file system. So if I could give you another illustration of how it works, it's kind of like this, right? That looks better, but you get the idea. So HD Insight is Hadoop running on Windows Azure. Now, just for the sake of time, I'm not going to, like I said, run this entire job. But what I do want to show you is what it actually looks like. So if we go to Hadoop on Azure, I had to change networks when I walked in here, so we'll load this back up. And sign in here real quick. You can see that I have a cluster running, and it has 3 nodes in it. By the way, you should probably note the URL, HadoopOnAzure.com. That's where you can go to sign up. And so if I go to my dashboard, or my cluster dashboard, so you can see, as soon as this loads up, that I have a bunch of options. So one of the neat things about Hadoop is that there's sort of the core technology, but then there's all these other technologies that sort of exist around it. And one of these is this JavaScript interactive console. And so, you know, it's like, okay, great, now I have this interactive console. Well, what I've done is I took this file, and let's actually pop over to Dropbox, and I'll just show you, I'll show you what the file looked like. And it was basically this big, ginormous, you know, 1.3 meg text file. And it's the notebooks of Leonardo da Vinci, right? So what I wanted to do was figure out how many times each word exists in this document. Right? So what I can do, and I can do this all in the interactive console using JavaScript, which is amazing, is that I can define this very simple function, two actually. And this does exactly what I was just describing. So I have a map function, takes a key value, right? And its responsibility is to take a line of text and split it. This is a really simple regular expression. You might want something more it takes into account more things than just non-word characters. And then it basically emits via the context that word and the number one. All right, so I'm going to write out a whole bunch. So if I have five, the word these, then I'm going to write out the, one, right? So I'm going to do that five times. Then I have the reduce function. And again, at this point, if I have the five times, then when this gets called, I'm going to get passed a key, right, of the, and then all of the values, right? So I have this list here. And what I'm doing is I'm basically just summing them, and then that's what I'm writing back out as the output of my reduce. Right. And so what I can do, and in fact I already have it up here, let's go back to this. There's a whole bunch of different things that are built on top of HD Insight, of Hadoop running on Azure, that you can take advantage of. So in this case, I already have, let's just do a listing of what I've got on here. You can see I've already got this top 10 words file that I outputted. So let's actually just load that up in the console. So we'll just say file is equal to fs.read, and let's say DaVinci, whoops, tab completion is a bit slower in the interactive console. All right, so now you can see this is the file that was outputted from my MapReduce job. And in fact, what I can even do is parse it into JSON. So we'll say data is equal to parse, and we'll say I have my file variable, so data. And then let's actually specify what's contained in that data. So I have a word and I have a count, which is of type long, right? So now you can see that I'm normalizing this. And I can even go a step further, which is to say graph, create a bar graph for that data. Now you can see that I've actually even got some visualization for the output of my MapReduce job. There's a whole lot more on MapReduce on HD Insight. I would encourage you to all go check out Hadoop on Azure and just jump in. There's so much to wade through, but just go out, check it out, and jump in with it. All right, scaling, or maturing, let's say, because it's not all about scale. It's a lot about scale. So there's a lot of different ways that we can look at scaling. Compute scaling is kind of the obvious one, right? Can scale up, I can scale out. Up is to get a beefier machine, out is to just add more machines. But caching is another great strategy for scalability, and it's usually one that's a good bit cheaper. And then I have geodistribution, which is traditionally been something that's actually quite difficult to do in a way that doesn't have a whole lot of unintended side effects. I'm going to just show you this quickly, but I will tell you that this is probably the most boring demo on Earth because Azure makes it so simple that there's just frankly not that much there in terms of, you know, hoops that you have to jump through. So I go to a specific website in this case, and you can see I've got a couple options. So in shared mode, I can scale out the number of instances, right? So I just click on that, and I click save. Yeah, it'll probably impact my billing, which I'll then expense. So basically, I'm now running, as soon as it sort of reconfigures, because it's creating new nodes, and I'm done, right? I now have this website running on 3 instances behind a load balancer. Do you remember how hard this used to be? Like, seriously. So let's talk about scaling up, right? So now I'm going to switch to reserve, and for whatever reason, I'm super CPU bound, and so I'm going to scale it up to 1 4-core machine. In fact, you know what? I'm going to scale it up to 2 4-core machines because I want my next expense report to be more meaningful to my manager. So again, it's going to reprovision, redeploy, configure the load balancer. Come on. And I'm done. It's a big deal. Right? It's a big deal in how boring that demo was. Say again? I don't believe that feature is included in the CLI yet. They are rapidly growing the CLI. There's a whole bunch of new stuff, but I don't think that's in there yet. I could be completely wrong about that, but I don't believe there is. Okay. So let's talk about a few more things. Azure Cache. Any of you guys use Memcached? Distributed cache? Should? Is that what you said? I agree. Yes. So Azure now has a distributed caching service. It has a couple different modes, and I'll walk through those in a second. But one thing I do want to point out is that if you're using Memcached, it actually speaks the Memcached protocol. So in fact, you can actually just hook it up, and it works. So distributed cache has 2 modes. One is shared, and that is where you can basically carve out a piece of each of your web roles and get the sum size cache, the distributed cache, to be the sum of those. No, you mean the velocity cache. No, this is a new thing. This is actually more the distributed cache service. You can also have dedicated worker roles that are shared among multiple web roles. So you got a couple different ways to configure this just depending on what makes the most sense for your business. And of course, you can scale those cache provider roles just like you could any other role. So you're not boxed in at any level here. Content delivery network. How many of you build websites? How many of you build global websites? National? Regional? City? All right, okay, well, you know, hey, good enough. So how many of you use content distribution networks? The funny thing is you probably use them even if you don't know that you're using them. How many of you get jQuery from Google? Yeah, you're using a content delivery network. Or from ASP.NET, right? From any of those places, you're using a content delivery network. Did you know that Azure Blob Storage is configured to work with Azure's CDN? Did you even know that Azure had a CDN? Yeah. Azure has a content delivery network that has nodes deployed globally, and it is configured to work with Azure Blob Storage. In fact, enabling it is almost as boring as scaling. Right? You just go and you add a CDN endpoint for a blob storage collection, it gives you a new host name, and then you just point to it. And the coolest thing about Azure CDN, as opposed to some of the others, is that it's a write-through cache. How many of you guys know what write-through caches are? So it works like this. I get a Azure CDN host that I then reference from, let's say, a web page. Web page makes the request to Azure CDN and asks, hey, Azure CDN, do you have this? Azure CDN says, no, I don't, but because I'm configured to work with blob storage, I know where it is. So Azure CDN will then go get the resource, pull it back to Azure CDN in that geography, at that CDN node, that edge node, cache it, and then return it, so that when the next request comes in, it has it and it returns it. It's a really nice way to go about taking advantage of a content delivery network because it doesn't require you to sort of be in the business of always remembering to push all of your assets into the CDN. Now, the one thing I will say that is kind of a bummer point on this right now is that you have to go back to the old Silverlight portal in order to turn it on. It doesn't surface through the new awesome Azure web portal. So, little tear, it'll be fixed soon. Okay, Traffic Manager. So not too many of you are doing websites in global scope, but that's okay because this is really stinking cool and we'll just talk about it very quickly. So the idea is that if I have applications that are deployed in different data centers, different parts of the world, I want to use them intelligently. Now that can mean a couple things. It can mean that as I want to route you as a user to the closest data center to you. It could mean that I want to use it as a failover strategy, a high availability strategy, so that if one data center goes down, I can just turn it off and point traffic to the others. Or it could be a load balancing strategy, which is I want to, you know, sort of round robin traffic to all of these different nodes. So Traffic Manager works with DNS. So in this case, I make a request to howard.com. It goes to my DNS where I registered it, but then that points to a Traffic Manager host, which then has a bunch of policies from which it will select one of the IP addresses, whether that's a load balancer or whatnot, and then it will actually return that in the IP lookup. This is all part of the DNS protocol. From there, my end user can talk directly to that machine. Now, time to live then works just like standard DNS time to live. So when the sort of DNS cache fuel or the time to live for this host to IP mapping expires, then it will flow back through the Azure Traffic Manager request flow. But this gives you, like I said, there are three policies. I can use it for proximity, for geolocation. I can use it for high availability, or I can use it for load balancing using a round robin algorithm. All right, have I taken you over time? If so, I'm really sorry, but I was having a lot of fun, and I hope you were too. So, sort of following on what we've been talking about, the theme, right, is Azure is all about how we've built it and how we're envisioning it. It's really all about removing friction, right? Whether that's time to start, whether that's how you test an idea, the size of the idea, or what maturing looks like. Azure's all about removing those points of friction, removing those barriers. And as such, we believe that Azure is really the cloud platform that lets you test ideas at the speed that you can have those ideas. So next steps, if you haven't signed up for a free Azure account, like, you're only cheating yourself. Go sign up. Get an Azure account. It's free. It's a fun sandbox, fun playground. And then, you know, we've covered a lot of stuff, right? This was kind of the Howard's favorite things episode. So we've covered a lot of stuff, and we've covered it at a very high level. So go play with it. Get deep in it. Get your hands dirty. And then finally, let us know how we can improve. You know, I stopped carrying business cards a long time ago because my email address is just howard@microsoft. So email me. If you play with it and you have some suggestions on how we can improve it, email the team. All of these teams have very, you know, public-facing presences, whether it's on GitHub or their own project websites We have stuff on GitHub, we have stuff on CodePlex. One thing I will mention is that a significant portion of these tools that I've shown you are actually open sourced. So if you want to contribute deeper, great. Clone the repo. Send us a pull request. We're happy to take them. So that's all I've got. I'm really glad that you came out, and if I did take you over, I'm sorry for that, but thanks for hanging with me.